Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The One Up Podcast with Gary Williams is presented by Peter Millar. Wherever you go, lead a life styled with luxury apparel from Peter Millar. Well, this edition of the One Up Podcast brings together two guys who started out and are really, truly of the same vintage, early 70s. First guy won his first tournament on the PGA Tour in 1971. That's Hale Irwin. And the other guy, Lanny Watkins, his first win 1972 in Las Vegas. He beat a guy named Arnold Palmer by a shot. And over the course of their careers, reputations that were built, formed, and sustained as being two of the toughest hombres to not only play in their generation, but all time. So here is my conversation with two members of the World Golf Hall of Fame, Hale Irwin and Lanny Watkins. Hale, Lanny, I have always thought, at least as I've tried to understand the game, as I get a little bit older, now 53 years of age, I think you two are part of the greatest generation. There was a book written by Tom Brokaw about who he thought was the greatest generation in terms of our country. I think in the professional game, the era in which you competed was the greatest generation. And I think the most talented people recognize the most talented people. So, Hale, let me start with you. When you first played or saw Lanny, what did you recognize about him that you knew he was going to have a Hall of Fame career?
Well, I think Lanny would concur here that we see an awful lot of talent come along. There's a lot of people can hit a golf ball, and that's certainly one of the measurements by which we determine whether someone's going to make it or not. But a lot of it has to do with heart. A lot of it has to do with how you carry yourself, your confidence level. It really comes from within. It's frankly, I feel this way, and Lanny may or may not concur, but I think the talent is probably the secondary measurement. It's what do you do with that talent? Because we've all seen great players come and go, and the ones that have gone may have great golf swings, but they didn't have it between the ears or in the heart. And you've seen players that really didn't look like they could play dead, but they made it. So it's really hard to say, but probably what I saw in Lanny was confidence. And I love to see confidence in people. I love to see a bit of a swagger to their walk. I love to see them out there expressing themselves in a positive way. And that brings about an awful lot of positive results.
Lanny, how about you? I know how much, first of all, I know what he just said resonates with you. You like people who have chops. And Hale Irwin had a reputation as somebody who could stand tall when it mattered most. What about him did you respect so damn much?
Well, the way he played the game, the way he handled himself, his competitive fire. If I had to go up against anybody, I didn't, you know, I had to pick a whole lot of other people before I ever got to Hale. He was as tough a competitor as I ever saw. And quite honestly, I think we're a lot alike in a lot of ways. Our games are even fairly similar, although he was a better putter than I was. But I think we both drove it straight, good iron players, probably around the same length off the tee. So that was one reason I thought we made good Ryder Cup partners. You know,
I hit the ball farther than you, Lanny. I hit the ball farther than you. Come on.
No, not unless you had some hot ones somewhere.
Well, I did.
You know what's interesting is that, you know, for both of y'all, you talked about Ryder Cup. And the Ryder Cup, by its very nature, because of the format, is a confrontational thing. And Lanny, you've already said something. You said, I could pick a lot of other guys I would rather go up against. And even though the golf course is your competitor, and Hale, I know you've talked about it because you played football, but in playing football as a defensive back, you had your guy. There was something confrontational about both of you that was a good thing. Do you think that golf today at the highest level, is there enough depth of that? There's a lot of depth of talent. Is there a lot of depth of that?
I don't think there's as much confrontational stuff as we used to have just because of the personalities. Now, all of a sudden, we're seeing some from Brooks Koepka, which makes me like him even more. He's an immense talent, obviously, but I like the way he plays with a chip on his shoulder and, you know, a lot of guts, and he talked about a guy with some swagger. He's got it. You know, it's a funny little story. I ran into Dave Stockton traveling up here yesterday, and Dave was Hales and my Ryder Cup captain in 1991. And, you know, he put Hale and I off first the first day, and you know, because he wanted the first point. I said, yeah, if nothing else, we were going to mean him to death. So, you know, we were going to get a first point. And that's just the way we both felt, and we did. So we welcomed Colin Montgomery to his Ryder Cup career with a 5-4 loss.
That's what I mean, Gary. See, I like guys that got that swagger, got that confidence. I just sit back and I take the reins, and I let Lanny go beat him, and I just sort of enjoy the ride.
Yeah, I don't believe that. He stuffed a whole bunch of irons, especially that first nine. All I had was tap-ins.
You know, it's, you know, for both of y'all, see, this, when I talk about the greatest generation, it's not just because of the fact that you like the competition and you were highly competitive. I'm talking about what you had to deal with. It was the back end of Palmer. You're in the middle of the Nicklaus vortex. You're at the beginning of the Watson ascent. But the other part that I think gets lost too much is that you had to play well to put food on the table. This was not a, you know, I had a nice week, and, you know, I'm going to get on my net jet, and I'm going to go to the next event. The pressure was not just because of the competition. It was about legitimately having to make a living. Did that pressure ever get to either one of you, all those things, who you were dealing with and what the result meant, literally, quantitatively?
Well, if I could jump in, I think I welcomed those that era, Gary. I think it was to be with Arnold and Jack and the great players, and to see Tom Watson come in. And, you know, we had that brief period where Johnny Miller was playing so well. To see these players that have been stalwarts of the modern day of golf was fantastic. I enjoyed that, and I didn't think it was at all a hardship at all. Now, the hardship was trying to beat them when the money was far less than what it is now. And I never thought of it being, I got to put food on the table. Yes, it was a necessity, but it was a learning curve for me. You know, I didn't start playing golf professionally with the idea in mind I was going to fail. While it took me a while to get my feet under me, I would not have done it had I not felt that there was going to be something at the end of my break-in period, if you wish. And those guys just showed me how it could be done. When you look at Arnie's swing, and you look at Jack's swing, and you look at Tom, and you look at these guys of yesteryear and how they approach hitting the ball and how they approach playing it, it's so much different than today's players, which really kind of have very, very similar swings. And the way they play it is very, very similar. And, you know, take Lanny's swing. You take Hubert Green's swing. You take players that were great players and won major championships. You couldn't superimpose them. They were different. And I learned from all of that. And I think it was just a matter of time where those players that had the heart and had the want and had the will were going to succeed.
And I agree with that, you know, almost entirely. And, you know, the people we played with were really exciting. I mean, you're talking about growing up and playing with people that were your idols. I mean, you know, I went to college on a scholarship sponsored by Arnold. So here I am playing with him on tour, money games, the whole deal. The other group at Hail Miss, I mean, we played a lot with guys like Sam Snead was still playing
yes.
the tour full-time when we got out there. I played a lot with – I got paired a lot of Thursday, Fridays with Sam. So just getting – I'd go – he was the one person I'd go watch on the practice tee. It was exciting to see, you know, his talent, what he could make a golf ball talk. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, he was, you know, both you guys, you won your first events within a year of each other, 71 and 72, and Snead finished in the top five in majors. He finished in the top five in the PGA in 74, and he was 62 years old. That kind of stuff is, I mean, you're right, it's extraordinary. We haven't even mentioned Ray Floyd. We haven't mentioned Lee Trevino. I mean, that's what I mean about the greatness of the depth of the generation of iconic players. When you start to win on a fairly regular basis, commercially, it wasn't like it is now. What did you have to win to reinforce your belief that you were as good as Johnny Miller or Jack or Trevino? Because you didn't have commercials on television with you on those commercials telling you how great you were.
Well,
go ahead, Hale.
No, I wasn't really worried about commercials. I was worried whether or not I was going to have, as you mentioned earlier, food on the table and send kids to school. And the basics were of prime importance to me. Lanny mentioned that he went to school with an Arnold Palmer scholarship. Well, I didn't. I went to school with the Grim Reaper playing football. And that was...
It just took you a while to wise up.
Well, it took me a while to run away from that dude.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt like I worked my way through college. In as much as I enjoyed it, it was not something that I knew was going to be in my future. I was trying to get through that so I could perhaps get to my future. Now, bear in mind, and Lanny will remember this, that when we were years ago, you could not talk about being a professional because that was intent by the rules of golf, and you were then deemed a professional. So these young people today, they can perhaps get some counseling, get some advice about turning pro. We could not do that then. You kept it under your hat.
No question. It was a whole different world back then. It really
right.
was, and with amateur standing and everything else. And for me, golf was a way out. I grew up in a house with seven people in one bathroom. It was not exactly, you know, I wasn't silver spoon blue blood by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, you know, we fought, and the fact that two tour pros came out of that house, my brother Bobby and I, is kind of amazing.
No, it is amazing. There's no doubt about that. You know, Hale, it's interesting that there are different things that I've read through the years about you playing football, and not just playing football, playing it at a high level, being an all Big Eight defensive back. There's a line that I want you to explain if this is something that you think is transferable and was for you in golf, and you think it's necessary for a lot of athletes just in general. You said that you needed to play over my weight. Can you explain what you meant by that, and if that is something that is a mindset as much as it is a physical trait that you needed to transfer when you decided to make golf your vocation?
Well, when you weigh 180 pounds, you're not the biggest man on the field. And generally, I was one of the smallest. So it was my belief that I had to, when I would say that, I had to hit harder. I had to be more aggressive than one would look at me and say, well, look at that skinny little punk out there. You're going to have to get my respect. And so that's the way I played. And while that may not be the right way to go into playing golf, that's what was in my DNA. And that's why I think football I enjoyed. I had great teammates. I had a blast playing it, but I knew it was a short-lived time. And to turn that off and go to the rather sublime and the wonderful world of golf, was very difficult, and I think that's probably one of the things that I had to try and learn of myself was where was that line in the sand where I could not cross. I couldn't take that attitude away because I didn't have the talent that a lot of people had, but they weren't going to beat me because of effort. They might beat me because of talent, but that's just what I had to carry with me in the early years, and I think it really helped me steady the ship, so to speak, in the early years when things were kind of rocky. And being around those players that we have mentioned already, they all had that same thing in some way, shape, or form. Maybe not from the football, but they had that. You don't think Lee Trevino had a background that's a bit storied? You don't think that Arnold Palmer from Latrobe, Pennsylvania? You know, there are other stories out there that you have to admire and respect.
Yeah, no question. And hey, this, don't forget that Hale also won an NCAA when he was at Colorado, as well as being an all Big Eight safety. So he probably is one of the best athletes that's ever played the Pro Tour.
No question.
You know, you spoke of Sam Snead. I just got to tell a real quick story about Sam Snead because I think it bears fruit to what we've been talking about. I was in Paris, I think it's 1974 or 5, playing in a tournament, and Sam, as you mentioned, Gary, he was 60-something years old, 62 or 3 years old. But we were at this cocktail reception, and of course over there everything is late. We're going to dinner rather late, and we're standing around in a coat and tie. And we were getting ready to leave, and there's a group of us talking about how athletic and limber and cat-like Sam was. And so there's this door arch going out, and I looked up at it, and it was probably, well, in Europe, you know, the doors are a little taller, so let's put it at probably 8 feet. And I turned to Sam and said, "Sam, can you kick the top of that door jamb?" And he didn't say yes, he didn't say no, but as we were walking out, just like a cat, this man leaps up in the air, one leg up, hits that door jamb with his foot, and comes down just like a cat falling out of the sky, lands on his feet, and just keeps walking. Doesn't look around to see if anybody can see him. And there was this footprint up on the wall above this door jamb. Now, at 60-something years old, I don't care how old you are. Just think of it, this guy and his athleticism. Unbelievable.
It really was. I think I've seen Sam do that more times than I can count. He was probably just an amazing individual.
You know, to compare eras, a lot of people find it's hard to do. It's a frivolous exercise. Or there have been books published using, you know, Z scores but. If there's anything that is transferable that you can compare, Lanning, let me start with you. What do you think is the most comparable thing or most sensible thing to say, you know, this guy was in this era, this guy was in this era, but I can look at these two guys and tell you that this guy was equal or better than that guy. What would it be?
Well, I think when it gets down to it, it becomes wins probably. I don't know what else. You sure can't use money as a barometer. The guys playing today blow by what we won in our career. They blow by in 1 year from that standpoint. The other thing, I mean, when you compare eras, it's kind of like it's the one reason I'll always consider Jack the greatest player over Tiger. And I say that because of who he won all his majors against. You know, not only did he have, you know, 18 majors, but what, 21 or 2 seconds in majors. And you look at it when he won all those tournaments, you had Arnold won in 8, Watson won in 8, Player won in 9, Hale won in 3, Floyd winning 4. Then you had a whole bunch of Crenshaws and Kites and me and people like that. So Johnny Miller, I just don't see that depth of talent that has won majors compared to Tiger. And, you know, so that's to me, he didn't beat the quality of players, you know, that won majors that Jack did. And that's why I'll always think Jack is the greatest player.
Hale, what about Jack stood out? Because, you know, if for the younger generation didn't get to see him play, The narrative is about how he let the other guy make the mistake. He plodded along. He hit everything hole high, which I think is doing such a disservice to – you talk about athleticism, but speed and power in the height in which he hit a golf ball that was far inferior to today's ball. But when you played with Jack, what are the things that stood out?
His score was lower than mine. That always bit me right in the butt. I just, Jack had a way of playing the game. I won't say it was vastly different than the rest of us, but we have to look at, as Lanny was talking, I'm trying to come up with a comparison here. Let's just compare the muscle cars of 1960 something versus the muscle cars of today. How they look, how they ran. Both were powerful, but there was a crudeness to the old muscle cars, and today's with far smaller engines, perhaps less built-in horsepower, but produce more compression and get more out of it. They're more efficient, and that's what I think we're seeing in golf. With today's talent versus yesterday's talent, you have different equipment available. So Jack took a lot of what today's player does and did it then. He hit the ball higher than most. He didn't curve the ball the way many of us did. He hit the ball much straighter like they do today. He took the old equipment and made it work much like today's equipment and made it look effortless. If he needed an extra 10 or 15 on his drives, he got it. And it didn't curve offline. You don't see Jack.
The other thing about Jack, I'll say this too, is I think he is the one guy that would have been equally as good in today's game with today's equipment, because it would actually fit him better than what he played with. He would have been even longer. He'd have been straighter. His iron game would have been good. And he still, people forget all the putts he made on greens that weren't near as good as what we play on today. And it was just incredible how well he did putt.
Well, let's put it, yesterday's greens are today's tees. Mm-hmm. It was so much better. And the fact that we have such talent around us, we appears, but I agree with Lanny in the sense that how deep is that talent today? Because I think the equipment brings everybody closer together. The separation of the best from number 50 is really hard to do, and that was real easy to do 30, 40, 50 years ago.
From the time you first started to contend and win, and you both had longevity, which is one of the great traits of a truly great Hall of Fame player, what specific thing, and it doesn't have to be good or bad, Lanny, what changed the most as far as tour golf from the beginning to the end on the regular tour for you? That you saw?
Obviously power became more of a thing the longer I played. The money never changed that drastically for me, probably, or Hale either. Yep. From when we came out, and it went from the purse for the week being $400,000 was a big purse when we first started, to we had $1 million purses, but they weren't the 6 million up purses that they have today. So I don't know. I think equipment improved. I think probably the biggest thing that I can think of was, honestly, that I thought made life a little simpler on the PGA Tour was golf shafts. Golf shafts improved an amazing amount when Joe Braley started with the matching sets. I remember when he was out there testing all of us and seeing what we liked. And then, it used to be, let's say you broke a 7-iron. Well, you'd be lucky if you got the correct shaft in that 7-iron, 1 in 10, in 10 tries trying to find one shaft. If you break a 7-iron today, it goes right in. There's no problem. You don't miss a beat. Things like that I thought just the consistency of the equipment got way better, second half of my career anyway.
Hale, how about you? What was one thing that really changed?
Well, I would concur with Lanny, but let me back up a quick story about Joe Braley. before he started that, Dale Douglas and I were out in Phoenix doing a little prep work before the year started, and Joe Braley came out to visit with us. And we got into a discussion because he was going to do this frequency matching shafts. And I said, well, Joe, I'll tell you right now, my 3-iron and my 5-iron and my 9-iron have different, what you call it, frequency. I say they are a little different, and I swing it slightly different to accommodate that because I know my golf clubs. Well, long story short is that, yes, I sent my clubs to him. Sure enough, my 3-iron, my 5-iron, and my 9-iron were different. And my point to him is that how can – I don't think it's going to work for you to take a pro like myself and immediately change his equipment. We're going to have to break you into a quick then. You can take a beginner and throw them into these shafts, which will be fine for them because they won't know the difference. But it's going to be a slow sell. And I think I was proven wrong on that one, but for me, I was kind of hard-headed that I felt like I knew my golf clubs. And the way I approached it was I played the game as low as I could, but as high I had to. I wanted to get the ball on the ground and running because the ball curved. And if I had to hit it high, well, I'd hit it higher. But my philosophy was hit as low as I can, but as high as I have to. And Joe's talking about now starting to get this ball up in the air, and I'm thinking, yeah, that runs counter to what I think.
Yeah, and if you look at all the great drivers, and I think Hale and I were two of them from our era that we all drove it. Nobody drove it high. We drove it on a line, you know, where it didn't curve. The great drivers we didn't have the ball curving. It went straight. And to do that, you had to, you know, the lower you hit it, the straighter you were going to hit it. I tell you, another thing goes to Sam Snead. Joe Braley told me, he said, I can't ever get Sam to test these clubs because all he had to do was make 2 swings and he could make any club work perfect. So in other words, if he could put whatever he wanted in Sam's hands and in 2 swings, Sam had figured out the shaft and made it go like it was supposed to. So,
you know,
he was a bad, bad test subject.
It's interesting about, you know, talking about all these various things, and the Ryder Cup is something that obviously changed a great deal from the first time you played as players, and then obviously Lanny, you know, on the back end when you captained in '95. When did you feel that it wasn't, whether it was media contriving things to inflate tension? 91 to me seemed like it was very contentious. It was there was friction, and it seemed palpable. Did you like all of it, or did you think some of it was a little bit too much?
Well, I mean, Hale and I played, and we played. We played both best ball matches in '91 together. We also played. I don't know if he played before '77, but that was my first Ryder Cup. I don't know if it was his. But we played together there as well. Definitely more contentious by the time Europe got involved. That changed the dynamic of it. It got a little tighter, more competitive. That was starting in '83. Personally, I enjoyed Kiowa. Yeah, it was it was combative. It was confrontational. But, and honestly, I think a lot of that you can blame on the Europeans. There was nobody more confrontational than Seve Ballesteros. I mean, he was going to be confrontational against anybody in every single match he had. And he kind of instigated that. He liked that because he thought he could always get under somebody's skin. So you basically had to get right back in his face and tell him to shove it. So, and that's what you had to do with him. You could not let him intimidate you in a match. And so, you know, I think that week added to that. And then, of course, you do what Seve and Ole Thobel tried to do to Beck and Azinger, and they didn't even know the rules, so they couldn't do what they were intending. So it's here again. I mean, yes, it was probably more confrontational than some people liked. Personally, I enjoyed it.
Well, I don't have any reason to change what Lanny's just said, other than it was the Iraq war.
Yeah.
We
yep.
were over there, and I always felt a little bit of a disservice to our military to call this a war at the shore.
Yeah.
Hey, this was not war. It was a Ryder Cup. It was, while it was high on our list of important things. It was way down the list compared to what was happening in over there in Kuwait and in the Middle East. So I was a little put off with that. But as Lanny just said, I think many of us, and you can throw Ray Floyd in there, you can put a lot of Paul Azinger, we enjoyed that. Dave Stockton, the captain, there's nothing wrong with a high degree of competitive spirit. And we had that, and Lanny's right. Seve was always at the core of any disagreement or any inflammation of tension. He just was there. But it was very healthy. I remember that Sunday night after we had gone to the ceremonies, we were coming back. I was walking next to Payne Stewart, and just out of the corner of my eye, Payne goes straight up in the air. And what had happened is that Ian Woosom had come up behind him, and Ian, being a very strong man, slipped his head between Payne's legs and lifted him up on his shoulders, just in a heartbeat. Mm. Well, that doesn't mean tension. It means that there's good, solid camaraderie amongst all 24 people.
Yep.
And the bad part is that the press, in somewhat their fashion, was really trying to inflame this into something that it really wasn't. You don't need the Iraq War. You don't need the problems that called the war to shore. We already had our own little battles going on.
You know, you both found yourselves.
I agree with that, with what Hale says, too. The only thing I would say, I'm not sure there were 24 people that got along. It might have been 22 or 3.
Well, you never could count, Lanny, remember?
Do you think now, because Lanny, I think that when you look at, particularly on the American side, that when you look at the construct of the teams now, and anytime I have this conversation, I always say to people, it's not an all-star game. It's the format is different. You guys partnered well together. The setups of these golf courses, they're very particular to the strengths of either side. And that I think that the Americans are too hamstrung by the personalities, the personas of the great players. And I think that's why Phil Mickelson was in Paris. He shouldn't have been on that team. He wasn't in good form. The golf course it didn't play to his strengths, but he's too big of a personality to bench him. And I think that the Americans, they build all-star teams. They don't build the right teams. Am I overstating that?
Probably, because, I mean, we have a definite, deal to qualify to get on the teams. Now they have more captain's picks now than, I mean, the first captain's picks weren't until, I want to say, 89 that there were even captain's picks.
Uh-huh.
The first two captain's picks ever were 89 were me and Watson. And, you know, when Raymond was captain. So that's changed that a little bit. So the captain has a chance to put somebody in there that I think is going to help the team in more ways than, you know, maybe just his play. So that's probably what it's after. But so I don't know that you can control your all-star team, if you will, because, I mean, that's the guys that play well over here year in, year out. They are the stars, and they're going to be on the teams. Now, and Phil's been a big part of those teams for, what, 10 or 9 or 10 Ryder Cups?
Yeah, his first Ryder Cup was 95. Yours.
Yeah, when I was captain. Yeah, I only played him 3 matches. I said I wouldn't let him play alternate shot. I figured nobody could find it from where he hit it except him.
Hale, did you always feel like you meshed with anybody? Did you ever have to say to any captain, I don't think this is going to work out? Or I did you even care about giving your input as to who you wanted to play with?
No, that's the captain's prerogative. I was a member of that team, and those 11 guys were my teammates, and I would go to hell and back for any of them. That's just the way I felt. It mattered little with whom I played.
I'm the same ilk as Hale. I played on 8 Ryder Cups. I never asked the captain one time to play with anybody. It blows me away that today's guys, get upset if they're not playing with their buddy. It's not about playing with your buddy. It's about, you know, kicking ass and winning. And that's not what some of these guys, what seems to be at the forefront of these guys' intentions.
Go ahead, Hill.
No, what I was going to say, I think, you know, Paul Azinger brought out, you know, when he was captain, brought out this,
the pod system.
The cell thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pod. I think that's fine, but I would have a hard time if I was a captain looking at my 12 players and sensing that one of them didn't want to play with another. If that was the case, then get off the team. I want 12 guys that have the heart and soul of red, white, and blue, and I want them to get along. And I may be asking too much, but I agree with Lanny. When you have people that can kind of pick who they want to play with, and they have to find their cry room. If they don't, then I don't want that person on my team.
Yeah, I think Hale and I would have a very difficult time with today's players and you know, the attitude that we displayed and we played under compared to what they do today. I think it'd be a very hard job being captain today.
Mm. Well, my first Ryder Cup was in 75, and Arnie was a captain. And, you know, Arnie didn't take a whole lot of guff from anybody. And it was Arnie's way or the highway. And it was, I remember his go-get-em speech was, I don't want them to win a point, you know, so we go charging out of the locker room. They're not going to win a point. You know, that's what you felt like. But that was simple. Unlike today, which is very complex. I don't know how you do it. To me, it's like a Ouija board. How do you do that?
I don't get it either.
I really don't. I mean, they're obviously the guys that want to play with their buddies aren't putting the team first.
All right, before I let you guys run, a couple last things, because Lanny, you're the voice of PGA Tour champions, and Hale, you're Bernhard Langer's trying to cross the Rubicon, and you're on the other side, and that's 45. Lanny, let me start with you. In order for him to get to the doorstep of what Hale Irwin did, which is one of the extraordinary achievements in golf, to win that many golf tournaments after the age of 50, what has to happen?
Well, I think, number one, he's got his interest level has to stay up. Bernhard's always fought putting. He's fought the yips. He didn't have to go to an unanchored long putter, which he's done very well, as has Scott McCarron. It's interesting to watch. Seeing more inconsistency from Bernhard I've been out here doing TV now for, I think, 6 or 7 years. I've lost track. But I don't see the consistency from Bernhard. He'll throw the odd, you know, really nasty round in there that's not as good. But then again, he'll do what he did at Lytham St. Anne's and you know, just play an amazing round of golf when you had to get it done. So I'll still be very shocked if he gets to Hale. I think age is working against him right now. But we'll see. His swing is getting a little shorter where it's never been shorter before. So that means he's got to be losing power. The courses out here aren't any shorter. If anything, they're getting longer. You know, look at Firestone we just had to play this year. So that's kind of what I see.
Hale, you're a proud athlete. I'm serious. Week to week, are you paying attention to what he's doing?
I watch with interest, but I would say Bernard's probably not on the doorstep. He's ringing the bell. He's well in to get let in the door. I would make a strong case that he's probably the best senior player to ever play the game, just from what he's done over his career, and at the age he's still doing it. At 61, is he?
62.
And almost 62 if he's not. But and like Gary mentioned, longevity on the Rugger Tour. I mean, this would be longevity on the PGA Tour Champions.
Yeah, I think what he's done is remarkable. I think the long putter thing is, it may be debatable, but it sure solidified his putting. he's become not only a good putter, but at times an excellent putter. But I do agree with Lanny, and I'll speak for myself when, you know, I felt like I still had a couple of years left in me, but I wanted to do other things in my life. It wasn't imperative that I win 46 or 47. That wasn't ever in my planning. It was spend more time with my family while I could, do some of the things that were of interest. I didn't have a bucket list. I have a barrel. So you got to start doing those things that you can do while you still have the interest and the ability to do them. And that's kind of where I am. You know, I can go out and hit golf balls and say, hey, I can still play this game. And then you go out and play. You think, no, I can't play this game anymore. You got to play out there on a regular basis. And just for interest sake, people say, Lanny probably took retirement. I took retirement several years ago. By mandate and by rule, you can only play in 11 or less tournaments when you retire, when that means you can start withdrawing from your retirement fund. So you can only play in 11 maximum events. So let's just say roughly that's one tournament every month. So is that enough to keep you sharp? No. So you'll start losing some of those abilities that you had, the little shots, the scoring that you once had. It's going to slowly go away. And we all know the difference in one shot a day. At the end of the day, after three shots, you just keep adding those shots up, and suddenly you're not in the mix anymore.
All right, we end it this way. I call it the press. It's five quick questions that each of you answer. Lanny, I'm going to start with you. What's the best shot you ever saw in person?
Wow, in person. Jeez.
I've got one.
There's... And which
Lanny
one?
Lanny won yours, by the way.
What is it, Hale? Which one is yours?
Well, Lanny's thinking, I saw Jack Nicklaus on the second hole at Augusta National, and I think it's 1975. We're playing the second hole, and he's hit it past me perhaps 10 yards or so. And he's going to go for the green in two, and he's debating on what club to pull. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I've hit it way out to the right. The flag's left, way behind the trees, way over there on the left side. And I've hit it way out to the right in two to chip up the length of the green. Well, Jack pulls out a one iron. I immediately think, God, he's going to try to go under the tree and roll it up into the bunker and have a short bunker shot. No, he took the one iron off that side hill, downhill lie, and hit it straight up there over the tree. I don't up the flag back to the green about 30 feet from the hole. That had to be one of the greatest golf shots I've ever seen. I cannot see myself even coming within 25% of being at the height he hit.
That's a good one.
That's incredible. And I mean, the one that comes to mind for me, I had to rack my brain here, I go back to Arnold Palmer. I played with him in the team championship one year at Disney, and he drove, you know, his best ball. So he drives in the left bunker on 18 at the Magnolia course. He's almost up against the lip. I could maybe get 7-8 iron over the slip. Arnold goes in there with 4 iron and puts it 8 feet from the hole. And I looked at him, and I just didn't know how he did it. And the one thing about that week, I played 7 straight days with Arnold as my partner. And I think you play with a guy that many days in a row and see all the shots, you find out real quick what makes him great. You don't, and it's not necessarily the one odd round here and there. It's watching it day in, day out for a week.
Wow, that's great. All right, now, Hale, the hardest golf course you've ever played in your life, what was it?
Wingfoot.
Yep, 74, and you won the U.S. Open there. I thought that'd be your answer.
Without weather being an issue.
Okay.
I played harder golf courses because of the weather, but weather was not an issue that week.
How about you, Lanny?
Yeah, I'll go with Wingfoot. Also, I hated Butler National. I thought it was just ridiculously hard when we used to play the Western Amateur there. But I'll go with Wingfoot in a heartbeat.
Okay, Lanny, when you were 21 years old, your celebrity crush, who was she?
Ooh, Raquel Welch. Why wouldn't it be?
Well, I mean, I'm not gonna dispute that. That's not a great answer. Hale?
Well, you know, you have to throw her in there, and I think Sophia Loren was pretty darn good, too.
I agree with that one, too.
All right. Hale, who was the most stylish golfer? I'm not talking about accomplishment. Who was the most stylish golfer in the 70s?
Let's see, stylish versus outlandish?
However you want to define it.
In the 70s. Oh, stylish. Wow. I think you have to look at, was that the age of the bell bottoms? That was.
Oh, yeah.
Baby.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it wasn't Roger Mulvey then. Well, we'll throw out Doug Sanders in his got awful mustard colored clothes.
That wasn't stylish, though. Yeah.
Who was Lanny? Who was a stylish guy in the 70s?
For me, day in day out, I thought he dressed impeccably because Tommy Bolt was his hero. And that's Tom Weisskopf.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew it.
Dressed amazingly well.
I was going to mention both Toms because you go back. Now, I didn't play with Tommy Bolt, but because the two Toms were pretty much that way, I would have to put Weisskopf in there.
Yeah, 6'3", cashmere, yeah, the whole thing. All right, last one, Lanny. And I've never wanted to ask this question more to two people than you two. The one player that you would, one more time, that you would love to walk in a singles match. You're going to play them 18 holes, and you're going to walk them in before the 18th green. Who would that be? Who would satisfy you the most to walk in?
Well, no question, Seve.
It would be Seve for you. How about you, Hale?
Oh, wow. That might be the most difficult at all. I agree with Lanny. Seve would have to be one of those. But you can't dismiss Jack and Arnold simply because of what they've meant to the game. But if there are two players in this world, but you said the name Arnie, around the world, people know who you were talking about. The other one was Seve. When you said Seve, people around the world knew who you were talking about. Mm. So it would have to be one of those two.
Well, Lanny and Hale, both of y'all, I want to thank you for taking the time. Two guys who played at the highest level for as long as you did, and both members of the World Golf Hall of Fame. So thank you.
All right. Great being with you, Gary.
Well, I thank again Lanny and Hale. For me, I went to my first professional golf tournament in 1973. I was 7 years of age. It was the Greater Greensboro Open, and both of those men were in the field. I was unfamiliar with either one of them, but as I grew to love the game of golf and then starting to follow the PGA Tour, there were two things that I remember most about each one of them. Their reputation of being the last guy you wanted to see with a one-shot lead standing on the first tee, trying to maybe win for the first time and having to deal with that guy. And then also the guy that you thought, if he had a mid-iron in his hand on the 18th hole, needed to stuff it to make a three to win a golf tournament, they'd be in your top 3 to 5, and they did it repeatedly. Two of the bona fide rough riders who were Hall of Famers in ability, skill, attitude. So I thank Lanny Watkins and Hale Irwin. And thank you for listening to the One Up Podcast with Gary Williams, presented by Peter Millar. Wherever you go, lead a life styled with luxury apparel from Peter Millar.